This is a Science Channel podcast. This Discovery Channel audio podcast is brought to you by Visa. We all have things we like to think about. Online fraud shouldn't be one of them, because with every purchase, Visa prevents, detects, and resolves online fraud. Safe, secure, Visa.
For the Science Channel podcast, this is Dan Sondak, and I'm here with Dr. Phil Plait, the creator of the Bad Astronomy blog found on Discover Magazine, also the president of JREF, the James Randi Educational Foundation, and he also has a new book coming out soon called Death from the Skies. I think what would be a good part to start on is president of JREF. Just what is JREF?
The James Randi Educational Foundation is a nonprofit organization that started over a decade ago to support James Randi's efforts to educate the public about paranormal claims and frauds who are out there trying to bamboozle people. And James Randi is an internationally known skeptic and conjurer, magician, writer. He's a great man who is really trying to do the public some good. And so since the past 10 years have gone on, the JREF has expanded quite a bit, and I'm coming in to hopefully increase the impact on education. I want to be able to put curriculum into schools, to do things online, to do more media work, to help educate the public to think critically. That's what we're all about. Being skeptical just means you have to think critically about claims that people make. Ask for evidence and understand how to evaluate that evidence. That'll make you a stronger thinker and a lot less likely to be fooled.
James Randi, is he actually pretty well known? Was there a deal with sort of bending spoons? Was that him?
Randi probably became most well known for debunking the efforts of Uri Geller, who was a self-claimed paranormal ESP, power of the mind guy, who became famous for bending spoons with the power of his mind. And what Randi showed is that everything Uri Geller could do, which he claimed to do psychically, can actually be done using sleight of hand or very simple tricks. And it's really great to have people who are magicians out there debunking this stuff, because they know all of these tricks. They know how to fool people. And so when people come along and say, I can do this with the power of my mind, the magicians can come along and say, I think it's the power of the skill of your hand, which is a very different thing.
And there is also, what was it called? It was either mental surgery or sort of like a magical surgery that there was as well?
A lot of people claim that they can do psychic surgery, which is they can reach into your body and pull out diseased tissue without actually breaking the skin. And this is just a load of baloney. It's all sleight of hand. These people are palming chicken guts or other types of little bits of meat or whatever, and then they pretend that they're sticking their hand inside of somebody, and then they just pull this previously palmed piece of meat out. And to the camera and to the eye, it really looks like you're pulling tissue out of somebody. But it's not. It's just sleight of hand. It's like making a quarter disappear when you drop it into your hand. This is an age-old trick that's being used. And I'm really glad there are people out there debunking it, because people are spending a lot of money when they're seriously ill to get this done. And it's not only not doing them any good, but it's preventing them from seeking real medical treatment.
And as part of the educational outreach, are you going towards more of looking at just the scientific process as a whole? Are you encouraging more scientific education in school? Are there specific sort of focal points that you're going to be concentrating on?
What I want to do is broaden the impact of the JREF by doing more work in education, not necessarily science, but just critical thinking. That applies, of course, to science, because scientists use skeptical methods whenever they're investigating the natural universe. If they see a phenomenon, they want to investigate it, develop evidence, analyze that evidence, and figure out what's going on. But we can apply this across all fields of knowledge, including literature, history, medicine, all sorts of things. What I want to do is to make sure that people have the toolkit they need to analyze evidence. They can apply it to any sort of thing. I mean, when you're buying shampoo or a car, you're using critical thinking. But it's still easy to get fooled, and we want to make sure that the public is a lot harder as a group to get fooled.
There is an episode of Mythbusters that aired, I think, actually last week, where our good buddies at Mythbusters, they actually went through a couple of the "we faked the moon landing" myths, and one by one just smashed them to bits. And you have the good fortune to be in the credits as special thanks. Well, congratulations on being in the credits of Mythbusters.
Thank you.
And so what is it that you did to get yourself in the credits?
Well, several years ago, I was writing my first book, Bad Astronomy, and I had a whole chapter in there about people who think NASA faked the Apollo moon landings, that the pictures were all created in a studio or some other place. And I took this on in the book, and it was right around that time that Fox aired a TV show which basically put out a ton of garbage about this, saying there were no stars in the pictures, the shadows weren't parallel, all this kind of stuff, these age-old claims that are really easily debunked. I put up a web page debunking them point by point. And over the years, that's sort of what I've been known for doing, is taking on the moon hoax guys. So when the Mythbusters decided to take this hoax on themselves, they contacted me about helping them out. And I had a lot of fun pointing them towards the pictures, the hoaxers, the hoax believers, that is, think, point towards the fact that NASA faked this, when this is all really ridiculous. So these are pictures where the shadows don't look parallel, or where there's no stars in the sky, or where the shadows themselves look a little funny. And then helped Adam and Jamie and their team work on the soil. A lot of these claims depend on the composition and reflectivity of what you might think of as the lunar soil, although the proper term is regolith. It's really ground up rock. Soil is when it's been processed by bacteria and other forces, but this is really just dust, ground up rock, and it has some peculiar properties, and I was helping them work on that so they could create their own and recreate the properties of the Apollo pictures. And when they did, they found that when it's done carefully and accurately, that the claims of the hoaxers is wrong, and that it's very clear that we did in fact go to the moon.
You had mentioned on your blog that they had done something that made you actually want to change your own lecture that you give on this. What was that?
Yeah, I need to think about this a little more carefully. The idea that the shadows aren't parallel, there's one famous picture of an astronaut, two astronauts standing next to each other, and the shadows aren't parallel, and there are a few other pictures like that. And I've chalked this up mostly to perspective. When one object's in the foreground and another object's in the background, their shadows don't look parallel. But that's the same thing as standing outside and standing in a parking lot, and you look at the parallel lines separating the parking spaces, they look like they converge or diverge just depending on perspective, like standing in the middle of railroad tracks and seeing them converge on the horizon. They chalked it up more to topography, to the rolling hills nature of the lunar surface. And I suspect it's actually a combination of the two, and it may depend on where their light was and a lot of other specifics. But it was interesting that they found that topography played a more important role.
I know that they were limited by time, by the amount of myths that they could bust on that. Were there any particular myths that you really wish they could have gone to?
Well, I understand that a lot of the claims, there's so many of them from the moon hoax people, that there's no way they could have done them all. They could have maybe done one where they show that you don't see stars in the sky simply because stars are too faint to show up in the pictures. But they decided not to go with that one and to go with some other ones, and I don't think that's that big of a deal. There are also claims about radiation and the astronauts would have died by the radiation in space and things like that. There's not much they could have done about those claims. Basically, you just have to sort of disprove them academically. It may not be as satisfying, and it certainly wouldn't make for very good television to just sit there and discuss this stuff. But I think, in fact, when all is said and done, what they did is they tackled the major claims. They did it pretty well. They mimicked the conditions as well as they could and showed that it's entirely possible and in fact, probable, and in my opinion, a certainty that these pictures were all taken on the moon by astronauts who were there at the time.
Do you think this will convince anybody that, yes, we did actually go to the moon?
Well, the guys who are out there beating their chests and claiming NASA conspiracies will never be convinced, because either they're totally blinded to reality or maybe they're out there conning people. I don't know. But there are people who might be sitting on the fence, or more importantly, kids, school children specifically, who hear these rumors and then go online and they find these hoax websites. And these kids can be convinced by hearsay, by what their friends are saying. And they're the ones most likely to see this Mythbusters episode. So the vast audience and huge appeal of the show is tremendous. I'm so glad that they did this, because I can talk until I'm blue in the face on the web and even given live presentations, whereas Adam and Jamie can make a single show and get this out to millions of people. So I'm really happy they did this.
And you even got your name in the credits to boot.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I have to admit, that was pretty slick.
And we are on the phone with Dr. Phil Plate, and stay tuned to hear more about his upcoming book, Death from the Skies.
This Discovery Channel audio podcast is brought to you by Visa. We all have things we like to think about, like, say, what's the best site to buy a new leather jacket, or whether to buy the 3 or 6 megapixel camera. Thankfully, we don't need to think about online fraud, because for every purchase you make, Visa keeps an eye out for fraud, with real-time fraud monitoring, and by making sure you're not liable for any unauthorized purchases. How's that for peace of mind? Safe, secure, Visa.
Can you tell me a little bit about what your book's about?
Sure. The book is coming out in October by Viking Press, and it's called Death from the Skies. And it's every single cosmic catastrophe I could think of that could damage or wipe out life on Earth. And we're talking asteroid impacts, solar events, the sun turning into a red giant in a few billion years, a black hole passing through the solar system, galaxies colliding, all kinds of crazy stuff. Most of it is really unlikely. The chances of a black hole passing through the solar system close enough to do any real damage to us are basically zero in the next few billion years. Over trillions of years, it's more likely to happen, but that's, you know, really far in the future. But it's fun to think about what would happen. How can a black hole hurt us? And it makes for a fun reading, and in the meantime, I get to go over the science of what these things are, what a black hole is, how they form, what would happen if one passes near you. And so the book, I'm not trying to really terrify people. It's just fun to think about this stuff. It's like going on a roller coaster. It's scary while you're on it, but you get off and your heart's pounding, and it's kind of fun. And you can look back on it and say, man, that was fun. Let's do it again. So you might read the next chapter in the book.
Okay, so on black holes, there are two black holes, as far as I know. So please feel free to correct me. There's the tiny, tiny, tiny black holes, and then there's the supergiant, massive, galaxy-destroying black holes. Do you cover these both?
There are actually several different kinds of black holes. There's the two that we know of for sure are ones that are formed when stars explode, and these might have 3 or more times the mass of the sun and might be a few miles across. And those were the kind that were discovered first. Then later on, we discovered supermassive black holes, which have millions or billions of times the mass of the sun. I cover both of those, as well as a theoretical kind of black hole called a quantum or a mini black hole that may have formed when the universe itself formed, and conditions when the universe formed were much different than they were now, and matter was getting tossed around, and it's possible to make black holes that have masses much smaller than the sun, maybe even the mass of a mountain or the Earth. And those might still exist, and if one of those passed near the Earth, you could get all kinds of problems. Again, really unlikely, and they're theoretical, but it's fun to think about what might happen.
I actually remember a book from a little while ago. It was called What If the Moon Didn't Exist?
Right, it's by Neil Comans, yeah.
Yeah, and it actually did talk about one of these subjects, one of these possibilities of a black hole actually winding up getting caught in the center of the Earth and just kind of sucking itself into a vacuum. Has science changed in any way, or is that still a possibility?
Well, for a black hole to be able to go into the Earth without destroying it, it would have to be one of these tiny quantum black holes that has a very small mass. The problem is, if coming from interstellar space, then most likely it's going to pass right through the Earth. Because of the way orbits work, it's extremely difficult for the Earth to capture a black hole. But even if it somehow could, the calculations I've seen show that it would take millions of years before it would cause any real problems. So I don't think this is going to happen. And in fact, if these things were common, the Earth is really old. It would have happened a long time ago. We wouldn't be here to talk about it. So it seems, statistically speaking, that these kind of things probably aren't going to happen.
That's always good to know. Well, thank you very much for your time, Dr. Plate.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
And tell people where they can find your blog.
Oh, if you go to badastronomy.com, you'll find my website and my blog, which is now being hosted by Discover Magazine. I'm thrilled to be a part of this magazine, which has been putting out good science for so long. And the old website is still there. You can find my movie reviews and my essays on various topics about myths and misconceptions in astronomy.
Okay, and thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
All right, and for the Science Channel, I'm Dan Sondack.